see you walk away from me, child.
Welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett with a raspy voice today, so I hope it doesn't get too out of control. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing, and today my guests are Andrea King Collier and Meg Wolitzer. First up is Andrea King Collier. Sorry, see there I'm going with my voice. I can blame it on that. Andrea is a freelance journalist and a national healthcare advocacy consultant. Her work in healthcare advocacy is informed by her own personal experiences and years of interviews with everyday individuals who strive for access to quality care. Andrea is in demand as a speaker and consultant on health advocacy issues, and she also is a journalist, degrees in journalism and in political science, has written for the Chicago Tribune, the Lansing State Journal, the New York Times, Savoy, Essence, Better Homes and Gardens, the Oxford American, Black Issues and Books Review, Writer's Digest, more, and other publications, and she lives in Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Andrea.
Hello.
Great to have you on.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about your book, Still With Me, subtitle being A Daughter's Journey of Love and Loss, published in hardcover by Simon & Schuster. Talk about how you came to write this book.
Well, I was working on another book proposal, and as odd as this sounds, I started dreaming about my mother, who seemed to be telling me it was time for me to write about her and our experiences at the end of her life. And believe me, this was not something that I wanted to do. I had resisted even talking about what had happened. And it was 10 years before that she died that we took care of her here in our home. But it was like she wouldn't leave me alone. So I put together a sample chapter and sent it over to my agent, hoping that she would say, nobody wants to hear about you. And the next thing I know, I was writing a book.
Huh. So how did you begin or actually choose what the sample chapter was going to be?
I started at the beginning. I picked the point where my mother announced to us that the doctors thought that she had some kind of cancer, because that was really the beginning of that roller coaster ride.
Yes. So, and that actually remains the first chapter of the book.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Talk about the process of writing, basically, I guess, a memoir, although it's about so much more.
Right. For me, the process was really interesting. I went to Anne Lamott's idea of writing a bad first draft. So I just sat down and told the truth as I understood it at that time, really fast. And then I went back and asked myself, how did I feel about those things? And sometimes in memoir, you hedge your bets. You want to be a good little girl that nobody's going to get upset with. So certain things you don't say. And then you have to go back and tell the truth about them. So from that perspective, I learned a lot about myself in the writing process by going through this, the process of doing this book.
Yeah, that's I think that's a great point, because one thing that writers, especially new writers, worry about is telling the truth, or the truth as they know it, and upsetting people, or making people mad at them, and you know, those people looking over your shoulder. I think it's a big problem.
But you have to tell, in my opinion, if you're going to write a memoir, if you're going to be bold enough to do that, you have a responsibility to the person who's going to read it to not hedge your bets, to tell the truth. And if you're not ready to do that at that point, write something else until you are. It's easy for me to say that almost everybody in the book was dead by the time I wrote it. So I didn't have to pay a whole bunch of attention to that. But for the people who were still alive, I wanted to make sure that I was being fair. And one of the things that I had learned from some of my fiction writing is that there are really no true villains.
Yes.
And that everybody's got a point of view, and you must be fair to that point of view. So some of the chapters that I wrote about people that I was angry with, by the time that I got to the final revisions, had been toned down quite a bit.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here with Andrea King Collier, author of Still With Me, A Daughter's Journey of Love and Loss. In terms of writing this, did you, when you got the contract, when you got the deal, the book deal, did you outline it, or did you kind of let it develop organically and just waited to see what would come out?
Well, I think that I had been sort of writing it in my head from the moment that we put the proposal together. And so by the time that the deal came down, I probably did a little outlining in terms of, if you're talking about the course of my life and then the course of this window, and you had to pick what parts of it you were going to talk about so that you didn't have some big War and Peace thing. So I did some of that. But it was probably about a page of bullets.
Sure.
And then so when I got to that part, then I could scratch it off.
This is such a moving book, and I'm curious how you chose what to keep and how you chose what to let go of, which there, you know, I'm assuming that there are pieces that didn't make it in.
No, they weren't. Well,
no?
There was one piece that didn't make it in because my editor took it out. But for the most part, I was a really good self-editor of what did not inform and move the story forward. And what could be taken away as a part of a universal experience in terms of people dealing with their parents, being caregivers, dealing with the cancer issues, and dealing with sort of the human issues of what goes on when somebody's sick.
Well, it's interesting that this book has sent you into, it sounds like, a new direction, as well as, I mean, what you're already doing. You know, you talk to so many groups now.
I couldn't have predicted that.
Yeah. Talk about that. Talk about what happened.
Well, I could never have predicted that I would end up doing a lot of talking about the book. And I also could not have predicted that I would have, that the subject matter would have been what it was. But I was having lunch with a friend of mine in Chicago and was telling her about how far I was along with the book. She asked to see a sample chapter of it. And she says, you won't believe this. I'm working with a group and a foundation whose subject matter is end-of-life care. So why don't you let us throw a party for you? So I'm thinking a nice little book party. And they threw a party to launch the book at a National Council of Aging conference in Chicago for 400 people. And that's what started it.
Hmm.
I didn't even have a copy of the book. I had a galley copy of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, there were lots of people in the audience who needed speakers. And so everywhere I went, my story seemed to resonate. So for the past 2 years, I've still been doing speaking based on that thing that happened in Chicago.
Hmm.
Before I even had a real book in my hand.
Sure. So it's so interesting how things come about.
Yeah, I could not have predicted it.
Hmm. When you were writing this, for instance, mm-hmm. chapter 18, the chapter about the Barbies. I mean,
yeah.
That's such a sweet, moving, emotional chapter. How did you get through chapters like that? I mean, were you just sitting there crying, writing some of these chapters, or do you have enough distance from your mother's death and dealing with it, dealing with her illness that you know, you were able to just pull back a little?
I was able to, for the most part, pull back and try to remember and then force myself to dig a little deeper. There was only one chapter in the book that I just fell apart when I was writing it, and it didn't have anything to do with me. It was about my husband's relationship with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had to stop. But the Barbies some of them were actually fun to write. And I think that it's important for me to say that the subject matter is heavy, but I couldn't write a heavy book.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of fun and interesting and laughable things that happen when somebody is sick. And it's okay to acknowledge that crazy things happen.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of twisted. You know?
I've gathered.
So I didn't want to write a sappy book. I wouldn't read a sappy book. So I tried to write something that would get to the heart of what my interests were.
Yes. I should say that I know Andrea from ASJA. We're both members, and she is quite a hilarious woman. So it's wonderful.
Thank you.
How is writing memoir like writing fiction? Is it at all like writing fiction?
I believe that it is. I didn't know that. But I've done some short stories before this. But I go every year or so to some writing camp like Sewanee or Squaw Valley or somewhere and immerse myself in fiction. So I get a lot of the little fiction lessons. And when I got stuck at a part of the book, I went to my fiction lessons, not in order to fabricate anything, but to create scene. I took my lessons from my fiction classes on how to create scene and how to create structure for telling the story. And I used the shell of that to move me through.
Hmm. Was there ever a question of doing this book as a novel?
No. Not for me. I can't tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot. If I had to guess, it has something to do with the cover of the book is a picture of my mother and I.
Yes.
In 1956. And this little picture sat on the fireplace in my living room. And when I was doing the proposal, I kept looking at this picture. And it became sort of the driving force.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, it became clear that I couldn't fictionalize it. I always envisioned that as being the cover of the book.
Interesting.
From the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, such a sweet picture. Oh, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Andrea King Collier, author of Still With Me, A Daughter's Journey of Love and Loss. We touched on this a few minutes ago, but in writing memoir, do you think it's a good idea to wait for a period of time before you deal with some aspect of your life that you really feel that you want to do a memoir about, or do you think it matters? Do you think everybody's different, and if you need to jump right in and do it, or wait?
I think that if you feel like you want to write about it, that you should. But I predict that anybody that lets enough time grow under it, the book would be totally different. I can assure you that if I had written a book the year after my mother died, the content, the text, the texture of the book would be different.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have now had a chance to get older and wiser and think about some things and understand how people handle situations differently from each other and be a little bit smarter about it, sort of global. That you can't have when it happened yesterday.
Yes.
Like one of the things that I'm thinking about writing, I write these little essays about, sometimes about my daughter and I. She's 19, but she's a drama queen. And so, somebody says, you should write a book about Nicole. And I think about that a lot, and I said, she got to get to be a lot older before I really do it. For many reasons.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So I do think that the more time you give yourself, that you probably are writing in your head and thinking about it and processing what happened to you and hopefully growing even after the event is over.
Mm-hmm. Well, you write in so many forms. You've written a memoir, you write fiction, you write articles, essays, you do business writing, you do just a whole range of things. And so I'm wondering if, or how you sort of stream ideas into the different forms. When you get an idea, does it appear to you, you know what it is, you know where it goes, you know what you're going to do with it, or do you start writing and it turns into something?
Probably early on, I didn't know. I just had to see what it was going to be. Now I pretty much know. Now I know what's going to be an essay. And now I know what needs to be a health service article. And I know what's going to be fiction. Except I'm working on something now that I'm taking bits and pieces of all my girlfriend's lives.
<This is fun. laughs>
And they slip me little emails and tell me, don't forget to write about this. But don't use my name.
What about writing fiction? Does it ever worry you, the doom and gloom that we sometimes hear regarding the selling and marketing of fiction and publishing of fiction? Do you think about that? Do you let it get to you? Do you just file it away and say, yeah, okay?
No, but you know what does, there is something about fiction that scares me, is that when I'm writing an essay or writing an article or writing this memoir, I always felt like I was on firm footing. There was never a doubt in my mind that I could do that. And I had it in a place that I felt very comfortable and confident with. But fiction scares me because if it's possible, it's even more personal.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much more. I mean, it's all about you. So if it's bad, it's just you. You know?
Now, that's interesting.
You can't blame the person you interviewed for being a bad interview. You know, you can't blame your relatives for not being crazy enough to make the story pop. You can't blame it. It's you and your head and the way you put it down on the page. So if it's bad, you were just bad that day. So it's very personal, and it's very scary because I don't think that writers want to be bad.
Yeah.
We want to be good. We want people to like us.
Hmm.
More so fiction writers. I don't know that the other people care as much.
Well, it is true, because it's ironic, actually, because fiction is apparently made up, even though so many fiction writers do base their fiction on some aspect of their real lives. But it's, you know, it's fiction, and yet it's more honest in certain ways, as you said.
I was at a writing conference, and some of those writing conferences, we workshop each other's work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the women in the workshop was just taking a beating about her character. And they said that her character was too crazy to be believable at all. Well, you could tell afterwards that she had fictionalized her own life.
Mm.
And that didn't go well at all. So for her, it was even more personal than for the rest of us.
Sure.
Because they also didn't like the character.
Mm-hmm. Well, that couldn't have been a good thing.
No.
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 Hmm.
But I sort of take it all with a grain of salt, except I do think a lot about, in every paragraph of fiction, I look at it and say, I wonder if this is any good.
Mm-hmm.
Which I never did. I don't do that with anything else. I just sort of assume it's good. But my fiction, I don't do that. I'm very timid.
Hmm. It's probably a good sign, huh?
I don't know.
In a way.
That's what I do.
Well, you know, I mean, it seems that when we are, you know, a bit nervous about something we're doing, we're probably, you know, stretching and you know, our standards are high, and it may not feel good to be worried or nervous, but it's probably a good sign that we're not easily pleased.
No, but one of the things that I learned by doing the memoir and working on other things is that pretty much it's all a crapshoot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter how good you think it is or other people think it is, there's so many other things that come into play. Like a writer that had a book, fabulous book, come out on 9/11. The book got buried naturally so, at 9/11. When it came out in paperback, it did very well.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things that you cannot control. Another book coming out just like it, you know, what the climate for that kind of book is. So you just have to sit down and do the best that you can do and then start working on the next project.
Yeah, that's right. Are you working on multiple projects at once?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm working on a men's health book proposal. I'm working on this novel, a book of essays about what it's like to be middle-aged and falling apart all at once.
And I'm sure it's totally funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that I started after I got done with Still With Me.
Mm-hmm.
So after you've gotten through talking about chemo and hospice, you just need to do something that has no redeeming social value. And that's what I'm coming from. Mm. I'm talking about sagging and bagging and, you know, all of those things that I wake up to every day.
How do you decide what to prioritize? What comes first?
I have a short attention span, so over the course of a day, everything gets a little it depends on, you know, I'm bored with one thing.
Yeah.
And then I'm off to the next.
Yes. It's kind of a good way to work, I think.
Yeah, and I don't put any pressure on myself.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1 o'clock, which is when All My Children comes on here in Lansing, Michigan, all life stops. Because we have to know what Erica's doing. Sorry.
So Erica's still up to it, huh?
Erica, yes. And then if you call me at 5, I can't talk to you because Oprah's on.
Well, it's been just a delight talking to you.
Well, thank
and,
you.
You'll be in New York.
Yes,
in
absolutely.
April,
doing two panels.
Say what they are. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the ASJA conference that will be happening April 16th in New York City. Go to asja.org. So tell me about your panels.
A two-part panel on career goals, planning, and the second part is four writers who set a goal last year and how they made that goal happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of an offshoot of the ASJ six-figure panel.
Yes.
Where people talk about how they make six-figure, but you don't really know how they did it.
Yeah.
So this is the opportunity to talk about how important goals and planning and having an organic document that you work from.
Mm-hmm.
And my agent is going to be there talking about how she works with writers to make sure that it's not just projects, that it's a career.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be happy to see you there, and hope some of you out there who are listening check out the ASJA website and possibly even show up at the conference. It always promises to be wonderful and useful and all that. Thank you, Andrea.
Well, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Take care.
That was Andrea King Collier, author of Still With Me, A Daughter's Journey of Love and Loss. When we come back, we'll be with Meg Wolitzer. Stay with us.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And before we go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. We spent the first half with Andrea King Collier, author of Still With Me, and we are back with Meg Wolitzer. Meg graduated from Brown in 1981 and published her first novel, Sleepwalking, the following year. Since then, she's written several novels, most recently The Wife, taught writing at places such as the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop and Skidmore College, and has written screenplays. Her novel, This Is Your Life, was made into a motion picture directed by Nora Ephron and co-written by Ephron and her sister, Delia Ephron. Her short story, Tea at the House, appeared in Best American Short Stories of 1998 and the Pushcart Prizes. Meg is often a contributor to WNYC's The Next Big Thing radio program, where she met Susie Roach of the band The Roaches, and the two of them began working together to put great literature to music. Her newest novel is The Position, and it came out just the last week or so, And she and a friend are currently writing a screenplay about a young girl's imaginary friend. She lives in New York with her husband and sons. Hi, Meg.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Great to have you on.
Thank you.
Will you talk about The Position and how this book came about?
Sure. You know, it occurred to me not too long before I started writing the book that never before have we seen an era in which there is nonstop sex and sexuality available, as well as such a sort of nonstop desire to squash it. I mean, they both seem to exist in one culture, in one climate. And I started thinking about how did we get to that point? And it made me think about the early days, the beginning. And I have a feeling that I'm really not alone in musing these things, because it wasn't very long ago that the movie Kinsey came out,
yes,
or that T.C. Boyle's novel about Kinsey called The Inner Circle was written. And I think all of us were coming to these ideas around the same time. It feels very long ago that the joy of sex was on my parents' night table, and my sister and I were borrowing it to look through it. And at the time, it seemed so graphic to us. But looking back on it now, it's in a sense a very sweet book. It's a very earnest book with this monogamous couple. And that whole time, the 70s, struck me with such a fierce nostalgia that I felt that I wanted to write a book about the family and about sexuality and about the culture. And this was the book I was going to write.
Interesting. You also write, and you have so much humor in your work. Have you always written funny?
No, actually, good question. When I first started my first novel, Sleepwalking, I think it had a kind of sly wit under the surface, but I took myself very seriously, and I wanted to write a kind of serious novel. And I didn't know yet, really, that the most serious novels often were really studded with wit, that you could have both. You could have it both ways. So it took me a while to really feel, I guess, secure enough to be funny in the way I was funny in front of my friends.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Will you read to us?
Yeah, sure.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Meg Wolitzer, author of The Position.
Yeah, I'm going to read from chapter one.
Okay.
I don't need to explain anything. The book was placed on a high shelf in the den as though it were the only copy in the world, and if the children didn't find it, they would be forever unaware of the sexual lives of their parents, forever ignorant of the press of hot skin, the overlapping voices, the stir and scrape of the brass headboard as it lightly battered the plaster, creating twin finial-shaped depressions over the years in the wall of the bedroom in which the parents slept or didn't sleep, depending on the night. The book sat among a collection of unrelated and mostly ignored volumes, Watership Down, Diet for a Small Planet, Building a Deck for Your Home, Yes, I Can, The Story of Sammy Davis, Jr., The Big Anthology of Golden Retrievers, and on and on and on. It was casually slipped in, this one copy of the book that the parents brought into the house. For if they'd stored all their copies, including the various foreign editions, and taped up boxes in the basement marked kitchenware or odds and ends, that would have sent a message to the children. Sex is filth. Or at least, if not exactly filth, then something unacceptable to think about, anywhere except beneath a blanket, in pitch darkness, between two consenting, loving, lusty, faithful married adults. This, of course, was not the view of the parents, who for a very long time had loved sex and most of its aspects, loved it so much they'd found the nerve and arrogance to write a book about it. When they thought of their four children reading that book, though, they brooded about what kind of effect it would have on them over time. Would it simply bounce off their sturdy, sprouting bodies, or else be absorbed along with the fractions and canned spaghetti and skating lessons, the things that wouldn't last, wouldn't matter, or perhaps would matter, coalescing into some unimaginable shape and gathering meaning inside them. But the parents' concern was mostly overshadowed by confidence. So why not put the book on a shelf in the den, a high but reachable shelf where the children could get to it if they wanted to, and the chances were good that they would want to, that no one would be struck dead by it, and life would just go on as it always had.
Thank you so much. That was Meg Wolitzer reading from The Position.
Oh, thanks.
Was this first chapter always the first chapter?
Yes, always. I knew I wanted to write a book about what would happen to the children of two parents who wrote a kind of joy of sex book in the 1970s featuring pictures of themselves. And what would happen to those children who'd been faced with the kind of shock and mortification of it? What kind of adults would they become? And I knew, really from the start, that it had to begin with them as children seeing the book. It had to begin with the primal scene, with the moment, and then from there I could kind of hurl forward in space. I love to move forward and backward in time when I'm writing fiction. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Yes, one of my favorite things to read as well. It's just, I don't know. Somehow, the idea of a linear story, sometimes you go, well, why?
I know, life is so linear. Can't we have, can't we break out of that when we're writing?
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point to writing fiction, is you're able to do things different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's important to me to do that.
How much did you know about the story before you began? I mean, it sounds like you had the theme well in mind, but what about everything else? Do you do a lot of heavy plotting or outlining?
I really don't, and the writing of the position was very strange for me. I wrote it in a kind of fever pitch. I wrote it quite rapidly, and I did do some outlining, but only in the most rudimentary way. I never really understood how to do an outline, and if I recently looked back on an outline I wrote in third grade of ancient Greece, and I didn't really know what it was. I would write like A, what they wore, A1, their togas and their food. I mean, I sort of didn't get the use of the outline, and to some extent to this day I don't really get it. But what I did know was who the characters were. As I started figuring them out, I didn't know what their trajectories would be. I really didn't know how they would end up, if everyone would end up alive. I had no idea.
So, were there any surprises along the way? Did anything come into the book that you just had no idea was going to do that?
Yes, definitely. I made one of my characters get sick, and I hadn't known that I was going to do that, get cancer. And it wasn't something that I'd planned, really. And when it occurred to me, I got very excited, but it took everything off kind of on a tangent in a way. But that's what writing is like. I mean, the best laid plans of novels really are there to be sort of decimated. That's the whole point. We're not writing a diatribe. We're not writing a pamphlet about something where you set out to make a point, and then by the end of it, you have made that point. It's much more open-ended.
Yeah. Well, what about when one of your characters gets sick or dies? I mean, how do you deal with that, or how do you let that happen? Because I think most writers, especially new writers, we want them all to stay alive.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to have to destroy a character we love.
Well, you have to love your characters. I mean, Salinger was accused of loving his characters too much, loving them more than God, you know. But you have to love them and care for them, and it's when you do that you can make these right decisions. It was very emotional, the scene, this character Dashiell, who has a bone marrow transplant, and he is in the hospital, and he has a very long hallucination, and he's convinced that he's leaving the hospital and entering a farmhouse. You know, this is in Providence, Rhode Island. And I was, writing this, and I was kind of riveted to it, and I didn't know what I would do with him, and I felt very upset. I felt my face was sort of hot as I was writing it. Mm-hmm. I had a very strong emotional reaction to it, and then, I don't know, I guess I made my peace with it. You know, I went and had a drink. they're characters.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Meg Wolitzer, author of The Position, just out by Scribner. Your writing is so detailed. There's so many visuals and so many really telling details in the section that you read, for instance, you know, the Sammy Davis book on mm-hmm. the shelf. I mean, you have so many really specific details. Do they come during your first draft? Do you kind of layer your work as drafts go on. How does that happen?
They really do come in my first draft. I mean, I think I even add more later on, but then probably the third draft, I'm taking them out. I am very visual. I am very metaphor-driven, perhaps too much so. It's almost like a little bit of metaphor Tourette's, you know, and I see the world that way. I really have a lot of details. I have a lot of, I memorize things in a room. I mean, when I was creating the den of this family, where the book that the parents wrote, featuring themselves having sex, was on a shelf in the den, I thought about that era and my own parents' shelf. Now, these were not specific books that were on my parents' shelf, but they were like the ones that were. And I knew, you know, those big oversized books on dogs or horses? There's something sort of sad and family-like about them. And for me, that's, I know that feeling. I know exactly what it feels like, and I wanted to recreate that because I don't think I'm such a freak that no one else has similar memories.
Oh, did you keep journals and diaries when you were a kid?
No, actually, I tried to really, really hard because I liked that they had a key. And, you know, that seemed to me really powerful, that whatever was in it would be, in fact, really exciting. But I was such a bad diary keeper that I went back once, and I saw that I hadn't written in it in, like, 3 months, and I felt really guilty because it was a Hanukkah present. And I went back, and on each page, I wrote in giant letters, "Nothing much happened. Nothing much happened." I was saving myself for fiction. I really was. I don't keep a journal or a diary, nor do I journal as a verb. I mean, I don't have that, you know, there's a finite amount of energy that you have in a given day. And if I'm going to write now, it's really going to be, it's going to be my fiction.
When did the fiction begin?
It began very early. I have a mother who is a fiction writer, and I saw her writing, and I thought, I want to do that. And I started writing. In first grade, I had a teacher who loved me and would invite me up to her desk, and she was like my amanuensis, and I would dictate to her because my penmanship was slower than my fiction mind. And these stories, which I still have, you know, were all like imitations of what I thought the adult world was about. Sometimes they were, one was about truckers. Come on, Jim. Okay, Mac. You know, I was just trying to figure out the world. And later on, actually, when I would walk to school, I had this very, very elaborate story, a serial novel, really, that I would tell myself in my head, and it was about the heirs to the Kraft cheese fortune and how screwed up they were. I mean, it was this made-up thing. I didn't know anything about the heirs to the Kraft cheese fortune. So it was always there, and I started writing for a magazine called Kids Magazine when I was 11, which was everything in it was by kids under 15, and the magazine got written up in the Times, and I went into New York to work in their offices, and I just love the autonomy of writing. I love not having someone, you know, give me evaluations. Well, I guess reviews are evaluations, but I can choose not to read them. I just like making my living by my wits. It's very exciting.
How do reviews affect you? Do you not read them? Do you just read, somebody will see one and say, you should read this one?
I read them, and I know that I'm supposed to say I don't and that I don't care, but I really do care, and I do read them, and I wish I weren't as thin-skinned as I am. I've been lucky. They've been very good for the wife and so far for this one. But, you know, I mean, it is someone's opinion, but I guess when I see a mean review of anyone, I get angry because there are very few books that really deserve a mean review.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are out there, fiction writers, in this nonfiction climate, just stumping. I mean, I really feel like fiction writers need to support each other. So when you're reviewed by another novelist, I just don't understand why everyone doesn't bend over backwards to be generous.
Yeah, or just don't review that book.
Right. Oh, I've really returned a lot of things to book editors saying I really didn't feel that I could, you know, do it justice in any way.
Right, right. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Meg Wolitzer, author of The Position, just out by Scribner. Talk about creating tension, because you do that so well, and you're not writing a mystery where there's a formula to getting tension on the page. You written a literary novel that keeps you reading because there is tension in each chapter. Will you talk about how you do that?
I think that you have to keep everything very taut, and if you find that a scene is meandering in a way, you need to go back and look at it again and say, what have I lost here? What is the imperative of these characters? What is the imperative of the scene? And if it really has no reason to be there except to have beautiful language in it, then it really has to go. And that's hard sometimes to realize that, because you can be very proud of something you've done. But the tension is everything. I mean, keeping it there throughout the book, making it sizzle sort of from start to finish, is pretty exhausting, and it does take a couple of drafts. But I think not being seduced by language is perhaps key for me.
And yet your language seems to be quite worked over.
Yeah, it's language is very important to me. I mean, I don't want to suggest that
right.
It's all about story at
sure.
all. But I think I guess writers know what it is they do like second nature and what's harder for them.
Mm-hmm.
The language was there before the tension and my sense of pacing. The language was there early. I always would hear things in my head and know what phrases I liked. I remember when I was starting to write, I read a phrase in a book, and I wanted to imitate it and use it in my own writing. I didn't even know what it meant. It was something, tears fell or something, like so much water. And I was like, what does that mean, like so much water? But I liked the strangeness of it, and
mm-hmm.
I used it in a way. So my sort of addiction to language and the strangeness of language comes quite naturally to me. But keeping up the tension and not being afraid of drama is something that I have to work at. And the language definitely gets looked over, and the best loved images get struck out, because I think that's the way to go. The things you love and nurture are the ones that probably don't belong there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I guess doing a couple of drafts is, for any writer, really important.
Hmm. What about revising? What is your process? How do you go into it? Do you let once you have a first draft, do you let it sit for a week, 2 weeks, a month, whatever, get some distance? Are you revising as you go along?
I'm definitely revising as I go along, and I think the advent of the computer made the whole revision process really, really different. When I first started publishing, I was writing on a Smith Corona and then a big IBM that weighed about 1,000 pounds and vibrated loudly. You could get lazy because everything you did had to be done with that white strip and you had
yes.
to keep replacing it, and it was this endless process. Very much like using the butter churn, but we did it. But I think now it's so simple to just get rid of an entire day's work and start again and, cut and paste, that we are perhaps more revision prone because it's not as onerous a task as it was. But I am definitely someone who needs gratification, and writers get very little of it, or at least wait long stretches of time before we get it. So as soon as I have a draft, I really want someone else to see it. I can't sit on it. I'll never sit there with it. I'll run it out to my editor, and I think she knows that I pretty much need or very much want to hear something back quite soon, because I want to get her in on the process. I want to get her involvement. It's now too lonely and too isolated and just too much in my own head to keep it further within myself.
Hmm. Interesting. We have a couple of minutes left with Meg Wolitzer, author of The Position. What do you read? Who do you read? What are you reading right now?
I'm reading a novel that I really love. It's coming out next month, and it's by Ishiguro. It's called Never Let Me Go, and I think it's brilliant. It's as good as The Remains of the Day, and I've been sort of yammering about it to all my friends. It's a very interesting novel, and I think he's just one of the greatest writers around today. He always does something very different. Although the books seem to have a sense of kind of yearning, unresolved yearning in them, which I see in his books and recognize in this one as well. But it's a terrific book. It's really good. I like Patricia Highsmith. I like Ian McEwan. I like reading Virginia Woolf, certainly. I'll read almost anything. I will really read almost anything. I read The Godfather recently because I'd never read it when everyone else read it. And I was struck over and over. He keeps using the phrase veal-colored lips. So, note to self, don't describe lips as veal color.
Oh, that's funny. We are at the end of our time. Do you have any words of wisdom or advice for the writers who are listening?
Yeah, I think that if something you've written is really good, it will see the light of day. It will. I still feel that that's true, that publishers are very eager to find something new and exciting, and that you should just read a lot, read really good things. Don't worry about being derivative of good writers. Read all the time, buy people's books, and just keep writing, and something of quality will surface.
Mm. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
That was Meg Wolitzer, author of The Position, out by Scribner, talking to us from New York. And what can I tell you? We're at the end of our time. I thankfully kept my voice, although I have been sitting here for the last hour in wearing sunglasses because I left my reading glasses in the pocket of a coat that I ended up not bringing. So I have on prescription sunglasses here in the studio. I don't mean to be so cool sitting at the mic, but here I sit. I want to tell you again about the ASJA conference that is in April. Andrea, our first guest, will be there. I'll be there. Lots of great people will be there. If you go to my website, penonfire.com, and you click on appearances, you will be able to link with the ASJA conference and other conferences and venues where I'm going to be. You can also write to me from there and tell me if you want to be on my email list, my weekly email list. And I'm going to leave you with a quote. Bye. Bye, bye, bye. Let's see who it is this week. I'm opening my book, Pen on Fire. And I'm going to read a quote by Mark Twain. I've probably read this to you before. Why shouldn't truth be stranger than fiction? Fiction, after all, has to make sense. Yes, it does. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week. Maiden's prayer. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM. Stay tuned for Between the Lines.
James became my lover on the day when he refused to saw me through the middle. Whoever thought of that trick, he said, had a sick mind. So instead I